call this Stephanie Doolin.
Hi, Stephanie.
With the Brownfields team. And our first speaker this morning will be Brad Van, followed by Bob Richards, and then I'll be speaking third, and last but not least, Jim Seiler will be bringing up the back of our presentation, and then you'll close with our question and answer session. Nicole, just let us know whenever you're ready for Brad to get started.
All right, I think, Brad, you can go ahead and probably start. We've waited about 5 minutes past the hour. Again, just remind people to mute their phones by *6 and to unmute by #6 when we open up the question and answers. Go ahead, Brad.
All right, thanks, Nicole. Can everybody hear me fine out there, I assume? All right, we're going to start off slide one, Brownfields Grant Workshop, Understanding the Proposal Guidelines. Again, my name is Brad Van. I'm a project officer here in Region 7, and I'm also this year's competition coordinator. My contact information will be at the end of this presentation should you have questions at a later date. I want to go ahead and advance to the slide number two. We'll get it here advanced in a second.
Well, everybody else.
Just knocking out the technical kinks for the morning here.
They can go ahead and advance so you can
start. Okay, well, I'll go ahead and start while our folks get caught up. Okay, what to expect. Again, the types of grants are with regards to 104K funding, and again, we're going to discuss predominantly those which are competitive. We're going to talk about some of the general proposals and the selection process. Now, again, we're also going to talk about first threshold, which is just eligibility. It's basically a pass or fail process. And then the ranking criteria, which is the competitive process. We're going to have an overview of both of those. And then there'll be some helpful hints and some opportunities for a little Q&A at the end of the session. So that'll be provided as well. Please advance to the next slide. Again, we're going to start off with a general information application process. So let's advance to slide number four. That's just a header slide. All right, this slide shows your authorized brownfield funding. And again, we're going to focus on those first three slide items there on the right, the assessment grants, the cleanup revolving loan funds, and then your direct cleanup grants. These are the competitive ones, which everyone's most interested in, obviously, today with regards to the competition. So that will be our focus. Job training and assessment assistance from EPA that you get from either directly from EPA or from your state and tribal grants are not going to be discussed in any detail here today. EPA must assure that 25% of all of its funding awarded goes to petroleum projects as well under this competitive process. All right. Again, and I want to note that this funding is authorized by the 2002 Small Business Liability Relief and Brownfields Act, so there's our government disclosure or disclaimer that we're going to throw in. Let's go ahead and advance to the next slide, please, or slide number five. All right, now, and I'm going to point out there's an error in this slide and the next slide, and I'm just going to touch on those very briefly. This is the national funding. We're close to the national funding total for last year. Again, that number really is $74.7 million at the top, not $2.4 million. Obviously, that's quite small. And the state and tribal dollars at the bottom are not part of that total. The state and tribal dollars are non-competitive. They go to programmatic for them. So that's not included, again, in that total. But, again, these are the programmatic breakdowns. And you can see that last year there were awarded, we're looking at 184 assessment grants, 12 revolving loan fund grants for cleanup, and then 109 direct cleanup grants were also awarded. Okay, let's go ahead and advance to slide number six. And this is Region 7 specifically when we're looking at funding. And I want to define, of course, Region 7 for those who might be calling in from someplace else. This would be Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska as part of Region 7. And in the past, Region 7 has generally received approximately 6 to 8% of the national funding. During FY06, we only received about 4% of the assessment cleanup, and assessment grantees were selected from the Region 7 proposal. Only 3%, or 23, of the 694 proposals received in the national competition came from Region 7. So that's approximately half of what we received during the previous year in 05. So clearly there's capacity for more proposals in Region 7. So that's why we're here today, to try to encourage that. One other little note on there, the cleanup grant shows that there were three awarded. Three were selected. One was not awarded because it did not receive property ownership, and the other two are still in a dispute. So actually that number is not correct. All right, move on to slide number 7. Give everybody's computer a chance. Move forward. Again, this is just the standard brownfields definition. And just the thing I want to key in on here is again, this is about real property. The definition of potentially also allows for contaminants such as interior asbestos, lead paint, mold, and meth lab residues. That's something that's not possible under your traditional Superfund project without the addition of a potential release of contaminants to the exterior environment. So that's kind of where brownfield sets a little different. Expansion and redevelopment or reuse may be complicated by the presence of potential presence. That's something else, that potential again, that is rather nice here with the brownfield definition as opposed to the traditional Superfund. Advance to slide number 8. And again, these are contaminants essentially that can be assessed or cleaned up. And I want to make a certain note. Of course, anybody can read their slides and see if hazardous substances, pollutants, and petroleum are your primary categories. And these will be divided between the assessment grants and the cleanup grants when you provide your proposals. Something to note on some of these other items such as asbestos and lead paint, they're preferably addressed as part of a larger hazardous substance or petroleum assessment or the cleanup project. Can be allowed to stand, they can be standalone projects, but proposals have to make a strong case for these contaminants, which are generally viewed as being lower in risk in nature. So generally it's preferred that they're actually part of a larger scale cleanup. Other contaminants may also include things such as mine-scarred lands, which aren't mentioned on this slide, but certainly fall within that category. Right, let's move on to the next slide, slide number 9. Okay. Yeah, and if anybody out there doesn't have their phone on mute, I just remind them to mute their phone at this time. I think I'm getting a telephone ringing. I'm sure everybody else is also. We appreciate it. Thank you. All right, let's talk about the competitive grant program. Again, this is a competitive program, and it's extremely competitive. Applicants should be prepared to put in quite a bit of time and effort to constructing a winning proposal. About two out of five proposals are selected for award. And each year, the number of proposals received nationwide has certainly increased. But the numbers of proposals from our region here in Region 7 have actually decreased. So, again, we're hoping to see that improve this year. On a national level in FY06, there were 694 proposals total received, and out of those, 305 were selected for award representing 209 recipients. So it is competitive, but there's certainly opportunities. Please advance to your next slide, the slide number 10. This is where we start talking about the actual application process. And again, you'll note that we had tentative up there. This is no longer tentative. We had the slide prepared, obviously, before waiting, like everyone else, in anticipation of the guidelines to come out. which they finally did yesterday afternoon, so we weren't able to get these changes in. So I want to note that the changes are the October 11th was actually the October 13th date. December 8th is the closing date of the competition, not December 14th. That was our best guess at the time. And so make special note of that, that it has to be postmarked and in by December 8th in order to be eligible. And then as far as the 2007 award announcement, it says spring, but in reality, it'll be spring, but it'll be late spring. It'll be May. And then the cooperative agreement itself, once the proposals are the competition has concluded and the proposals have been selected, the cooperative agreements have to be awarded by September 30th of 2007. And a couple of things to note for folks out there listening that may be fairly new to this process is after the proposals are selected and we work towards that cooperative agreement award, the applicants are going to have to file a standard federal form, and also a work plan will have to be submitted and approved as well. So awards may not be made if all pre-award criteria are not satisfied. And often one of the things that seems to trip people up seems to be the cleanup grants, which require property ownership, and we'll get into that later. But again, these pre-award criteria must be satisfied in order for the award to be processed. So it's never a done deal just because you've been selected. All right, let's advance to slide number 11. This is the 2007 evaluation process. And again, this just kind of goes over something I mentioned earlier. The competition initiates, first there's an evaluation of the threshold criteria, and this is simply a pass-fail. This will be done at the regional level as proposals are received, and this basically says whether you're eligible or you're not to receive a Brownfields grant. Then it will be followed by the national panel evaluations of ranking criteria. This receives a score, and this is again done by a national panel. It will consist of generally three federal employees from either EPA or their other federal partners that are working on the panel. And these will be ranked by other regions. So, for instance, you're here in Region 7. Your proposal will not be ranked by Region 7 employees, with the exception of the programmatic capability portion, because we best know what your previous history is like. So just remember that when you're writing these, that you want to write that for somebody that's never seen your community. And then, of course, once the panels are complete, the headquarters decision official will select the highest ranking, and they base this on a number of things. One, of course, is the panel ranking score, which is the point score. They look also, of course, obvious is the availability of funding. This program's never been fully funded for what it's been authorized, so they award all that they can. Other factors that weigh into this, and this will be in the guidelines in Section 5B once you see the new guidelines or have them available. There's certain items that they look at. One of them is fair distribution of funds between urban, non-urban, among the 10 regions, designation of a federal enterprise zone, enterprise communities, or renewal communities, how communities address environmental justice concerns, assist in addressing disproportionately high and adverse health and environmental effects for minority and low-income populations. So again, that plays into the environmental justice concerns. There is the obvious 25% petroleum statutory requirement, so that's going to be mandated to be fulfilled. And promoting long-term availability of funds under an RLF. And then, of course, there's tribes and official recognition for any sort of Department of Justice weed and feed programs. So these are just some of the initiatives and other items that weigh into their weighted ranking besides just the total generation of numbers and a bright line cut through those tabulated numbers. So let's advance to the next slide, please. Slide number 12. Basically, this is who's eligible to apply for the grant funds. Well, obviously, any general purpose of local government, states and tribes, and any quasi-governmental entities can apply for any of what we call the ARC, or Assessment Revolving Loan Fund, and cleanup grant types. Your fourth bullet goes into your nonprofits can apply under the cleanup or the direct cleanup grant, and private entities can apply for loans from an existing revolving loan fund, but they cannot directly apply for a grant. So that's where your private entities kind of fit into the equation. All right, let's go ahead and advance to slide number 13. All right, as far as applicant eligibility, again, they have to be one of the entities we just described on a previous slide. Other things to consider, too, they can't be a potentially responsible party or a responsible party under CERCLA, so they're certainly not going to be eligible. For petroleum sites, they can't be liable, and again, this is with regards to RCRA USPs. So there can't be any actions ongoing for those properties where there's another person liable for that contamination. And, of course, you can't be somebody that's been federally debarred from applying for grant monies. Advance to slide number 14, please. And, again, this is just a header slide. What kind of funding is available? So we're going to talk about the funding and what you're most interested, I think, in today. So we'll advance one more slide, please. Slide number 15, everybody should be on. Okay, we start talking about the assessment grant program. And a couple of things to note here. Again, as far as assessment goes, these could be community-wide or site-specific or any combination thereof. So when you apply for an assessment grant, you're going to apply for no more than two applications or submit two proposals per competition, but they could be any combination of that. You can have two community-wide, you can have two site-specific, or one of each. So again, these are $200,000 hazardous substances grants, or they can be petroleum grants. And again, under hazardous substance, you've got other items that fall under that. There is no cost share required for the assessment program, and there is a waiver that you can receive for a site-specific up to $350,000. So that's available too, but naturally that would have to be justified for the waiver. Again, we spoke, there's no more than two applications per competition year, but it can be any combination of the ones we spoke above. And again, we already discussed, these are petroleum or hazardous substances, but you have to make sure they're in separate proposals. Petroleum would be for one, hazardous substances would be for the other one. Go ahead and please advance to the next slide. The next one is the Brownfield Cleanup Revolving Loan Fund program, or cleanup grant under a revolving loan fund. Again, this is up to $1 million per entity. And this is a rather interesting one because this is where coalitions can come into play. If you have groups of eligible applicants, they may apply such as, where you get together with smaller communities trying to combine their efforts, such as regional planning commissions. They can also, it's really good for smaller communities to combine into coalitions because they may not have the necessary management structure to do one of these all on their own. So that really is a good way to get involved with the revolving loan fund. And under the revolving loan fund, of course, you can have sub-grants from the loans up to 40% of the loan amount, and that would be not to exceed $200,000 per site or property that you would be applying, they would be applying for those sub-grants. Again, these are for hazardous substance, petroleum, and other environmental hazards, and in this case, they can be on the same proposal for an RLF. The cost share on this does exist, it's 20%. You can get a cost share waiver, but again, it has to be very strictly justified in your proposal why you would want a waiver. So let's go ahead and advance to the next slide, please. And again, I'm just going over the very general of these. We'll get in, our speakers coming up after me, we'll get into details on each one of these grant types, so don't feel that you've missed anything. We'll certainly have time to get into much more detail on all these when we discuss the ranking criteria for each one individually. The third type of our art grant is, of course, the cleanup grant program. You can get up to $200,000 per property. And again, these are cleanups for hazardous substances, and of course, such as asbestos, lead paint, meth labs, etc., can fall under that hazardous substances. And also petroleum. You can have one for petroleum. May apply for up to three properties. Now, that's a change this year from last year. Please note that if you're kind of running off last year's guidance, you could apply up for five properties last year's competition. This year it's been reduced to three. And again, these all have to be separate proposals per property that you're applying for. So be certain that you do that. Again, nonprofits are eligible under this grant program. And there is a 20% cost share. And again, like the RLF, you can receive a waiver for that cost share, but it must again be justified. And this is the last item, and we put it in bold because it's the one that trips people up the most. And it's difficult for communities to get their hands around with regards to, you know, how real estate deals can be. But again, the person who applies for the cleanup grant must be the sole owner of the property. And this is the same as last year's requirement. They give you until June of 2007 this year. So you can be selected to receive your award in May, but certainly by June, you must be the sole owner of that property, or the grant will not proceed. And we ran into that last year. It's a bitter pill, unfortunately, but that's just the reality of the guidelines. And the reason that is there is because in the past, they had allowed till the September 30th date, but that really put the agency in a position of having money that even by September, they were not able, the person applying for the grant was not able to receive property ownership, and that just left monies then that we could not award. So by giving us the June date, if applicant A can't make it, then they move down the list to the next applicant, and they select someone for that direct cleanup and award the next person essentially on the list, they being headquarters. So let's go ahead and advance to the next slide, please. Okay, this is just a informational slide. Again, we're not going to discuss in any detail the job training grant program or the TBA program, but we just wanted to ensure that you had some contact information for our folks here at Region 7. Should you have any questions about those, both programs are excellent. And certainly the TBA program is a good way for communities to get assessment work done. It is not competitive dollars that you have to compete for. So especially for smaller communities, this is certainly a good way to get a property assessed. And you can come through us for the TBA program, or again, you can go to your state or if in case tribal counterparts, under their 128A program to get TBA work done. So that's why we just put that information in. Let's go ahead and advance to the next slide, please. Of course, it's just a header slide. We're going to get started. And let's start talking about some more general information here. Let's advance the slide one more time, please. Should be now on slide number 20. And the key to this slide really is about preparing. You know, this is a lot of work to put in one of these proposals, and they take a bit of preparation. And some of the keys here are included on these bulleted items, like focusing on your target areas, engaging in your community, and so forth. And you can obviously read bullets. But one of the points I'd like to make is to contact your state early and get their help. You need to get a letter from the state agency anyway for any proposal you're going to submit specific to that property. So it's always best to engage them early. I mean, they may be able to assist you with, a TBA or something, and resolve some of your issues. Otherwise, you still need their support, and you're certainly going to need to keep them engaged once you get into these voluntary cleanup programs. Let's go ahead and advance to the next slide. Again, you should be on slide number 21. And again, these are just good basic proposal preparation practices. And you have to remember, I think some of the key things to remember is that people review these, and people are inherently people. Reviewers, like I said before, will consist of three federal personnel, but they will likely know absolutely nothing about your community or its problems. So think about this. When you're writing a proposal, you want to make sure that it's an organized proposal. It doesn't make the reviewer do all the work. Don't be afraid to cross-reference to other sections to show some continuity. You have a page limit, 2 pages for your cover letter, and for the proposal itself, it's a 15-page proposal. Stick to that, because I guarantee you, if you send them a proposal larger than 15 pages, nobody gets to see it. It goes through headquarters to their contractor, and they remove those additional pages on the proposal, so it won't help you to try to squeeze one in. However, and this is important, remember, you can have as many attachments as you require. So if you need to attach, this is a good place to put your map of a site. If you want, visuals really help. The state letter, letters from your community group showing support for this, even if you want a photograph of the site. But make sure these attachments are relevant. You know, do not attach an entire phase one or phase two, because, you know, quite frankly, nobody's going to read it. But you can certainly attach a summary if you've previously had something like that done, so that doesn't hurt. Also, make sure all attachments are reproduced well. By the time they get to the reviewers, they're going to be at least second generation. So make sure they reproduce and that they are on an 8.5 by 11 size paper. That's pretty important, because otherwise they'll get cut off again. So let's go ahead and advance to slide number 22. And this is, again, this is where we're going to start talking about threshold. And threshold, remember, that's the first portion. It's just a pass-fail. It's your eligibility to apply for a brownfield grant. So, and we'll move forward here. Let's go ahead and move to slide 23, because this is the header slide. And these are your threshold criteria. And as we go through these, and Bob Riches is going to be coming up here in a minute, you'll see that we put header slides in here periodically, kind of let you know where you're at. And we're going to start with, of the threshold, let's start with applicant eligibility, eligibility, if I can speak. And the thing to note is there's a big change in this header slide, and I want you to note that last year, and this is probably one of your most important to catch, especially if you're dusting off an old proposal from last year, community notification, which used to be an eligibility or threshold requirement, is no longer part of that. The community notification, which was originally like item number 2 of the threshold, has now been moved into the ranking criteria, and it'll be discussed later by one of our other speakers. So again, if you're dusting off an old proposal, you're going to have to revise that accordingly. So I just want to give you a heads up on that. Let's go ahead and advance to slide number 24. About applicant eligibility. And again, we already kind of keyed on this earlier. Who's eligible to apply? Well, municipalities are. State and tribes, quasi-governmental organizations. For all three of the ARC grant types are eligible. Nonprofits can apply under the cleanup grant program. And then coalitions can also apply under the RLF program. Advance to slide number 25, please. All right, this is the same as last year. Again, you want a letter that is current. So you can't use last year's. So again, if you're dusting off one from last year, you're going to have to go to your state and have them provide you or your tribal authority with a letter to go along with your proposal. And that's it for me. I'm going to, at this point, I'm going to introduce Mr. Bob Richards. He's from our office of council, and he's going to go ahead and proceed with site eligibility and property ownership eligibility at this point.
Thanks, Brad. I am going to do just a little quality assurance, quality control here. I just feel like I'm speaking into a box and I can't hear anybody else. So I'm going to ask somebody from Missouri to press, come online and just say you're still hearing us. Are we still out there?
We're still here, Bob.
Excellent. Okay. I just would hate to do, you know, all 15 hours of this and find out that we hadn't had any, we'd been cut off. I'm happy to talk about this, and I just sort of want to do a little pep talk while we're sort of resting here at slide 25, I guess is where we're at right now. The thing that I want to really focus on is that this may seem a daunting task to do this application, but it is worthwhile because frequently that assessment dollar or that cleanup dollar for your development program in your community is going to be the hardest dollar to find, and that's what this money really is. It's sort of like seed money to get your project going. You wouldn't be in this business unless you were an optimist or you didn't lack the perseverance to go forward and do this redevelopment. But basically, with the money in hand and your skill, and you need a leader in your community to really push this, you're going to often reach a tipping point where you're going to get that proposal, that redevelopment that has been just sitting there for years going forward. And so I will let you know that we're going to be here certainly to help you on the threshold issues, and each of your state agencies are going to be here to help you on your ranking issues. I'm going to, I guess, get back on program here, and we are slide 25. Let's move on to the next 26. It's sort of a placeholder, and I'm going to be discussing primarily the site eligibility and property ownership eligibility. These are issues that EPA's internal delegations puts on my desk, and so I guess I get the opportunity to talk about it to everyone. So let's go to the next slide, number 27. As Brad had indicated, for assessment, communities, we'll skip down to point number 3. Private property owners cannot apply directly for grant funds, but they can apply for the loan, so that's where the private parties come in. The other thing is that for the assessment work, the property does not have to be owned by the grant applicant. It can be held by a privately held party that is going to give you access to do the assessment work. If you're not familiar with the sort of flow of environmental work, initially there's the assessment, and then there's the cleanup, you know. I get confused on that, but it's the money flows, I guess, for either assessment or the cleanup, and one of the things or beauties of the new law is that it allows you to move into that cleanup with the money, provided you follow some certain rules that I'm going to apply in a few minutes. Let's go to the next slide. Site eligibility. We have basically two types of sites. We have the hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants, and then the petroleum sites. The eligibility rules are different for each one. As Brad had indicated earlier, 25% of our funding needs to go to petroleum sites, so we're happy to look for them. But if you don't have a petroleum site, go with the hazardous or vice versa. The petroleum sites typically are going to be some of these abandoned gas stations. They may be other facilities where you have petroleum in the ground. And you're going to have to be working with the state for some determinations that the state makes that it's a relatively low-risk site. There's no viable party, and there's no current corrective action enforcement occurring at the petroleum site. For the hazardous sites, as Brad had indicated, it's a little broader than just the definition for our Superfund cleanup authority, because we require releases into the environment in order to do our enforcement. Well, this grants program is not an enforcement program, so we have a little tweak on the rules, and that is we do look at asbestos still in a building, or lead paint, or say other contaminants that are not necessarily released into the environment. Next slide, number 29, I believe. This is where I come in as the lawyer. The Brownfields law prohibits EPA from providing grant funds to an entity that is considered potentially liable under CERCLA. That's the Superfund law. It's a very broad liability provision. It is highly dependent upon how you acquired the property, when it was acquired, and therefore we're going to be asking a bunch of questions along that line to make sure that you meet this threshold element in your application. The broad liability provisions are basically part of EPA's polluter pay principle that was an element of the program since it was passed in the 1980s in response to some of these really tough Superfund sites. The unfortunate thing is that a lot of communities had brownfield sites, lower risk sites, that got caught up in this, and so we had some development that was stymied. Nonetheless, the grants program still has this provision in it, but the new Brownfields law created an exception. So we'll go to slide 30. Typically, we're going to be looking at municipalities as our applicant who is going to be applying for these competitive grants. And frequently, as a governmental entity, they are going to have some authorities as a sovereign that private parties don't have, and that's tax foreclosure, eminent domain authority, or then they can simply purchase or receive a donation. The first two elements there, tax foreclosure and eminent domain, I will just mention briefly before going to the next slide, those have, if they meet certain rules, and I'd be happy to discuss them on the phone with you as you're preparing your application, those are exceptions to CERCLA liability, so those get you in the door for the cleanup grant where you cannot be liable under Superfund, but you still have to own the property. And then purchase or donation is something that is a little new. I guess we're a little farther down the road under the Brownfields law, but as we'll go to the next slide, we'll make a further discussion on how a property can be, I guess the city can purchase or receive a donation of property and still avoid Superfund liability. The Superfund law previously, prior to January 11, 2002, had a very broad liability provision that if you acquired ownership and you're in the chain of title, you're going to be liable. A lot of people think that's unfair, but speaking as an enforcement attorney, it really gave EPA some tools to make some settlements. It allowed us access to properties. We did some mitigation of the harshness, perhaps, of the CERCLA liability. But under the new law, the Brownfields law, there are certain exemptions besides the tax sale and eminent domain and innocent landowner that are going to apply. Prior to this law, January 11, 2002, it had to be the previously existing exemptions that you see up there. And for grants purposes only, the appropriations bill generally allow us to reach back, provided you still meet the liability requirements that we're going to go through on bona fide prospective purchasers. So let's go to the next slide, number 32. And this is if you acquired the property after January 11th of 2002, if you meet the definition of what is called a bona fide prospective purchaser, BFPP. That's probably what I call the gold standard for governments and private developers actually can avail themselves of this in the redevelopment process. But for the grants process, the governments are going to want to make sure that they follow the rules for this method of acquisition of property. It's called bona fide prospective purchaser. So I will tell you, let's move forward to slide 33. And it allows, I don't know that you let me see, 33? Yeah. You folks have this in front of you. You can purchase the property with knowledge of contamination. It's a purchase only acquiring the property after January 11th of 2002, and all of the disposal of the hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants had to occur prior to the acquisition of the property. Let's go to slide 34. To qualify for the bona fide prospective purchaser liability limitations, or actually an exemption to CERCLA liability, there are two threshold criteria that have, and we talk about threshold criteria here as having to occur prior to the purchase, and then five continuing obligations that have to be in place and stay in place after you acquire the property. You are subject to windfall liens. I don't think you're going to have to be worrying about that in this context for the assessment grants. Certainly, the grant money is going to clean up a property or assess a property. You're not considered under EPA's policy on windfall liens anything that we're going to slap a lien on a property for. The detail, the sort of Bible that I refer to people, developers, and I think you should go on the internet, EPA site, and find it. It's called the Common Elements Guidance. It describes these two threshold criteria, five continuing obligations, and gives you examples of how each of those play in acquiring the property. Next slide. We are at number 35. These are the two threshold criteria, and again, note prior to purchase. First of all, you cannot be a potentially responsible party or affiliated with a potentially responsible party under Superfund. What that means is you cannot have generated the waste that is found on the site. You cannot have transported the waste that is on the site. You cannot have owned the property and operated as a hazardous waste landfill on the property. You have to basically be nothing more than coming to the property fresh as a landowner, a new landowner. The second criteria is you have to conduct something called all appropriate inquiry into whether there are environmental hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants at the property. Previously, this was called due diligence. We now, under the new statute, call this all appropriate inquiry. We promulgated some rules on this. And it's going to, we'll be discussing those in a little more detail, but all appropriate inquiry, and you have to basically come to the property with clean hands. Next slide, number 35, please, or 36, excuse me. This is after purchase, and we have five continuing obligations. The first two are that if there's a zoning or a deed restriction restricting how you use the property, particularly with respect to the hazardous substances that may be on the property, you have to comply with that. You have to take something called reasonable steps to prevent further releases. This is not a full cleanup, and groundwater remediation is not required. EPA has a device that we call the comfort letter, and if you ask for it, we can provide it to you that defines steps. It's very fact-driven. Let me give you some examples. There are rusting drums of methyl ethyl death on the property. We are not going to necessarily require you to remove those from the property, but we would probably require you to overpack them in some sort of plastic drum so that you're not having the stuff leak out. If it's, say, a foundry site where there may be lead dust or asbestos just laying on the ground from some industrial activities, we may require you to put up a fence around the property just as a reasonable barrier to keep trespassers off the property. It's not a full cleanup, but it is going to require some thoughts, and if you have concerns about it, EPA can assist you on that by doing the comfort letter. Next slide, and I think we do 3, 4, 5 here. We are looking at now slide number 37. These are the continuing obligations that allow you to keep the bona fide prospective purchaser exemption. You cooperate with EPA. You give us access If we need to get on the property to do some sampling or a cleanup, you let us on. And if there's an information request or administrative subpoena, lots of times those information requests, if you've ever received one of those, are quite extensive. They ask for all your knowledge, all your documents related to hazardous substances at the site, and they normally set a deadline. If you're a day late, you haven't failed to comply with the information request to lose your exemption, but we do expect you to comply eventually. And also provide any legally required notices that you might be under the statute regarding releases that might be occurring at the site. And once you do the two threshold criteria and the three continuing obligations, you are a bona fide prospective purchaser. And a lot of our questions in the application are going to be related to that, how and when you acquired the property, to make sure that you are exempt, because we want to see this money flowing to you. We know you're an optimist, and we want to get the funds out to you. Next slide, number 38. The all appropriate inquiry, formerly due diligence, has a number of standards, okay? And when we give an assessment grant, that's basically, this is the product that you're going to be generating that would then allow you to go to the next step for the cleanup grant. Because you have to have the all appropriate inquiry, you remember, as a threshold to acquire the property and still be eligible for the cleanup grant. Until we basically published a rule November 1st of 2005, had a one-year delay for full applicability, but basically after November 1st, 2006, we're going to have two standards. It's the regulation called the All Appropriate Inquiry Rule and something called the ASTM E1527-05 standard. That's a phase one standard. It is specifically recognized in the All Appropriate Inquiry Rule, and it is probably the industry standard that any purchaser where there is a hazardous substances is going to require this. So that's the product we're going to be generating in the assessment work. If you haven't had an EPA-funded assessment, this is what we're looking for. Most of you, are, if you're applying for a cleanup grant at this point, you've had an assessment work. It may have been done under the 1527-05. It may have been done under some of these earlier standards or according to the rule. We just are going to be checking the time and making sure that it is a timely phase one, not too far, not more than a year prior to the acquisition of the property, and also that it was done prior to the acquisition of the property. Next slide, number 39. These are the cleanup questions, I guess, and I want to issue a caveat here. We do have the new guidelines have been published just in the last day or so, and they're yesterday, I'm informed. And so these slides are out of date as far as the numbering goes. I think Brad had outlined some of the differences related to community notification, and we just want to make sure that when you read this, don't necessarily look at the numbers, but look at the content, because the questions are going to be quite similar or the same. It's just the numbering scheme primarily is going to be different in the proposal guidelines that you're going to be finding on the internet. And they apparently are posted at the Brownfield EPA website, so you should pick them up there. Basically, we're going to be covering the cleanup grant because most of the criteria are going to fall under that, whether you're applying for the assessment or the revolving loan fund grant. And so we're going to go to slide number 40 and start getting into the meat of the matter. This is identified on our slide as question two. It's actually, I think, in the new guidelines going to be question number four. It relates to the question number two, needing property-specific determination. this is going to be very, very limited. These are properties where generally there's an ongoing enforcement action under some other cleanup program by EPA. You can get a site-specific determination. It comes out of the region. You need to request that early on. It's a threshold issue, and then we can work on it and try to get that determination. This basically relates to the polluter pay principle, but we also see that there may be instances where a brownfields grant is not going to be contrary to what we're able to do under the enforcement program for a particular site. Let me give you a for instance. We have a RCRA site, Resource Conservation Recovery Act. It's an operating facility, there's a potential for its redevelopment as something beyond just what the operating facility is. They are currently under some sort of corrective action order at the site to do a cleanup, but it may be that if there was some additional assessment related to a community reuse, we might be able to fund that, notwithstanding the impact of a corrective action occurring there also. That's just a for instance. It is something that we must approve, and it's going to have to be something that we want to see up front that you're requesting prior to that deadline of turning in the application. The question number four on your slide actually is going to correlate to numbered question five on the new grant proposal deadline. And this requires that there, for a cleanup grant, that there is a phase one performed, okay? This is not necessarily related to how you acquired the property under bona fide prospective purchaser, but this is just to make sure that there is something out there to clean up, okay? So the phase one environmental assessment that we're looking for here is so that when cleanup funds are, if they are awarded, there's actually something there to clean up. So you need to describe the cleanup plan and your estimated cost, and hopefully that assessment work in conjunction with some additional planning will allow you to answer that question. Next slide, number 41. This question number five on your slide correlates to actually question number seven in the current newly published proposal guidelines related to cleanup. And it relates to the enforcement actions that might be at the site. We want you to work with the states. The states are going to be able to determine, I think, to a large extent, whether there are any enforcement actions against owners, discuss the status, how it fits into the overall plan, and make an effort to get this information. Don't just assume that EPA and the state are going to be doing this legwork. We want to know what you know about the prior owners. The next question will actually focus on your own liability. And so let's go to number 42. This is numbered 6A through H. It actually corresponds to question number 8 in the new proposal guidelines. This is the how, what, who, why, how you acquired the property. Okay? And this is the stuff that I will be reading pretty closely. We require you to sort of make a legal conclusion at the end, but we want to see the facts, too, of how you acquired it, the date. Did you acquire it by tax sale, eminent domain? That might be an exemption to Superfund. Or if you acquired it by bona fide prospective purchaser, we're finding out, you know, that all disposal occurred before you acquire it, what uses you've made, whether you are potentially liable or affiliated with somebody who was a generator or disposer. The instance that we come in this situation might be a municipality operated a dump, basically, that accepted hazardous substances, or they contracted with a party that operated a facility, and there, so you are affiliated, your city trucks carried the material to the particular property. And unfortunately, that may not be, this program may not be the program to address that. And also see number 6H, I guess it would probably be under 8, some number, confirming the commitment to due care. That is sort of the reasonable steps that you have done to maintain your exemption to liability. Next slide, number 43. This focuses on the acquisition, and it's sort of a continuation. If you don't own the site, and this is for the cleanup, you have to describe your plan for acquiring it. The cleanup grants require that you own the property, you be the sole owner, and that you be the fee simple title owner of this property. Now, we realize in this whole development process that a city may not want to commit to owning that property until they have the grant in hand. And so our grant cycle process has you applying for the grant in November, a deadline in, what is the deadline, Brad?
It's
December 8th is your deadline. And then we evaluate them and make selections and announce them in May of 2007. We're going to, you may not necessarily want the property until you've received that notice that you're going to get the grant, okay? And so EPA does allow you to be notified that you're going to get the grant, but not actually have the property in hand. But you have to own it by June 30th of 2007, or you won't receive the grant. If you don't own it by 2007, we're basically going to take those funds and reprogram for the next party down the line who would be otherwise meet the eligibility requirements. The ownership, to demonstrate it by fee simple title, that's a warranty deed. A quitclaim deed doesn't quite do the job. And I don't expect all of you to be real estate attorneys on this, and I certainly am not an expert in the field. But what a quitclaim deed does is it says that the person granting the deed to you gives up all interest that they have in the property. It doesn't warrant that there's nobody else out there that has title to the property or some interest in the property. It doesn't warrant that the person giving you that title is the sole owner and has all of the interest in the property. So quitclaim deed doesn't necessarily do it. Sometimes that's all you got, though. And so what I would do if I was in your situation where you don't have a warranty deed showing that there are no other owners except the municipality, the applicant here, let's work with the title company and get basically a title report, an ownership report, and encumbrances, and that is a relatively small fee, and with that we can maybe have a title opinion that would elevate this so that we are assured that when grant monies flow to you, they're not benefiting some private party or some party other than the applicant, okay? Particularly note the bottom line there. If you're not sure, call me and let's discuss the matter, and I think we have the contacts at the end of the program here. Next slide, we're looking at number 44, the due care provision. This, again, is sort of the reasonable step. And show your commitment to all things with the land use. If the condition does not apply now, in other words, you don't actually own the property, indicate that you will commit to complying with it once you receive the property. This may be restrictions and institutional controls, deed restrictions. You'll cooperate, comply with information requests. These are all the sort of continuing obligations that you have as a bona fide prospective purchaser. I will say that these obligations also apply if you acquire by tax sale or anything else, because once the city acquires by tax sale or some other exemption to the Superfund liability, they still have to be a good citizen after they acquire the property. Next slide, number 44, please. Petroleum. Different rules are going to apply, and it's going to require you to work upfront with the state to determine whether or not the petroleum site is eligible. These are different from hazardous substance site eligibility determination. It has to be a site that is low risk. There's no viable, responsible party capable of performing the cleanup. And we have a certain period that we're actually looking back on this. I think it's just the previous owner immediately prior to the application for the grant. And then that the funding is going to be used by a party that's not potentially liable for the cleanup. And the site's not subject to a corrective action cleanup. These determinations, the states are well adept at making, and they understand that sometimes they're going to be making these determinations where there isn't a lot of information out there on the site. But nonetheless, we need to reach some sort of conclusion and have that coming from the state in order to make the determination. So the application is cleanup question number 7 on this slide. I don't know what it correlates to, but you will see it clearly marked for petroleum. Next question. This is sort of the tie, you know, slide number 46. Petroleum has continued. Immediate and current and immediate past owners, no responsible party. These are the specific questions. We're also looking for judgments, orders, or third-party suits. That determines whether or not there's that should not be sweeps, that should be suits. Whether or not there's actually an enforcement action occurring there. And the financial viability of the responsible party, we're not going to consider, say, eligibility for a state insurance fund as evidence of financial viability, because that's a contract that is not necessarily going to be paid. Okay. Next slide, number 47. You have to pass the cleanup, the threshold criteria: applicant eligibility, letter from the state, the site eligibility, and property ownership eligibility. And then we look to for particular types of grants: the cleanup authority and oversight structure. The legal authority to manage a revolving loan fund applies only to the revolving loan fund grant, and the cost share applies only to the RLF and the cleanup grant. The assessment grants are probably going to be the easiest to apply for, in as much as providing information if you're at that stage, because you don't have to own the property, you don't have to show these additional elements, and you don't have to come up with a cost to share. Next slide, number 48, please. Again, just sort of outlining the differences among the assessment, RLF, or direct cleanup grants. For the cleanup and RLF, you have to describe how you're going to oversee the cleanup and whether you're going to enroll in a state or tribal voluntary response program. We highly encourage that you use those programs even for the assessment work. And in the cleanup-only grants, you have to describe how you're going to obtain access to the adjacent or neighboring properties if you need to do that in order to accomplish the cleanup. RLF-only, a legal opinion stating your authority to access and secure sites in the event of an emergency or loan default, that comes out of your law office of the city. Next slide, number 49. Again, looking for an opinion from your legal counsel that you can manage a revolving loan fund. Many of the municipalities are probably doing this for lots of their infrastructure programs, such as the sewer or water system, where you have a you've received funds, you're collecting monies, you're loaning money out, and so forth. You have to have the authority to hold the funds and so forth. Generally, cities have this under their general authorities as a sovereign, but we need to get that letter from the attorney, the city attorney. Next slide, number 50, cost share. I'm just going to go on through these and describe what the next slide, actually, number 51, talks about the cost share. It's a 20% cost share. It's considered 20% of the total federal funds awarded. So, okay, let's do the calculation. You apply for a $200,000 cleanup grant. You have to come up with $40,000. $240,000 is going to be spent on the total project. Some of you who split hairs might think that, well, $40,000 is not 20% of $240,000, but the way we calculate it is it's the $200,000, then whatever of the federal funds, you have to come up with 20%, okay? That's how the math is done. That's about as much math as I'm able to do. It can be in the form of contribution of money, labor, material, or services. It has to be an eligible and allowable expense under the terms and statutory elements for the grant. We have something called administrative cost prohibition, and when you apply for these and you're coming up with your cost share, describe something other than just administrative cost, okay? We've gone around in circles on that. Give us a call if you have a question on the threshold issue on how you describe the cost. You can petition for a hardship waiver. These are basically real hardships, like bankruptcy, things like that. At this point, I'm going to go to the next slide, placeholder, and Stephanie will be speaking at this point about some of the ranking criteria, and I'll just relieve you. They've already taken away my microphone, so goodbye, and good luck, Steph.
It's like the hook, Bob.
Okay.
Good morning. This is Stephanie Doolin, and I just want to thank you for your participation in this training session. I really like doing these clue-in internet training sessions because I think they're an economical way to get the word out, and they're especially targeted for an audience that has some familiarity with the Brownfield program and the competitive grants process already. Because as you can probably tell at this point in the presentation, we're moving through a lot of fairly technical stuff pretty fast. And so I just want to give a quick advertisement that at the end of the presentation, there'll be information on two upcoming face-to-face training sessions that we're going to be giving, one in Omaha and one here in Kansas City, that will be all-day sessions. And they will provide much more detail on all the topics that we're quickly going through. And I just thank you for your patience. We had to plan this internet session more than 2 months ago because we had to get information out and do the advertising and get it all set up. And we were just sort of taking a big fat guess at when the proposal guidelines would come out. And as you can tell, the guidelines came out on Monday, whereas we had to have our slides posted by last Thursday. So I appreciate your patience with the fact that some of these slides don't exactly correlate with the guidelines, but I refer you back to the guidelines that are now posted on the internet. Be sure to refer to those for any things that we might have guessed incorrectly on when we put together this presentation. So with that, I want to go to the next slide, number 53, and get started talking about the ranking criteria. The points totals are kind of strange this year. I don't know why we can't make these be 100, but we just don't do that. So with that, I'll move on to the next slide and talk about the individual ranking criteria, get started on it. Slide number 54, please. The breakout, this slide is a transition slide, but it contains the points totals for all the individual parts that make up the ranking criteria. And so if you kind of glance down through there, you see that some things have changed. Particularly, I call your attention to the fact that, as Brad noted, that community notification has moved from threshold to ranking, and so it now follows the criterion for community involvement, and it has 12 points assigned to it. And so we'll get there in a minute and talk about what constitutes those 12 points. But another important thing that I want to call your attention to is that across the board, the reduction to threats to human health and the environment criteria is now 30 points. Last year, for the revolving loan fund and the cleanup grants, it was 21 points, but now it's 30 points for each type of grant. So there are some important changes in the points total. And because reduction of threats to human health and the environment has a 30 points value to it, you should pay particular attention to that criterion and address it well. Moving on to slide number 55. On the budget. The budget looks an awful lot like last year. There are examples that are in there. You should always give a short introduction for your budget and explain each one of your tasks well. Bob kind of mentioned this in his presentation about use of the word administrative. Appendix 2 contains the prohibitions on the use of funds. If you have any questions about what's administrative versus what's programmatic in terms of the task, please consult that appendix, and also you can call EPA for information and to help you identify things that might not be allowable costs. Generally, in the review panels, reviewing applications for other regions, I noticed that that's where people messed up on this criteria, is that they put in unallowable costs. So be careful about that. Follow the sample that's provided and pay particular attention to justifying your equipment and your supply budget items. That's another place where people mess up, is they have maybe a lot of money in the equipment or supply budget items and they don't explain themselves well what that is, and so they lose points. Moving on to the next slide, number 56. When you're applying for hazardous substances and petroleum grants, please submit separate budgets, and of course, as was noted earlier, separate proposals are required. There also is, within the law, the ability to direct 10% of your grant money toward one of three budget items: monitoring of health populations, monitoring and enforcement of institutional controls, or other program development type activities. If you do this, be sure to clearly explain what it is you're doing and show it on your budget. Be sure that you've carved out a certain amount of money for this activity, up to 10% of the total grant. Moving on to slide number 57. This is just the way the sample budget looks in the proposal guidelines. I want to call your attention to the fact that in the 2007 guidelines, they request more detail on the budget. Particularly, it's asking for how many assessments you estimate that you can do with your money, and that's something that a lot of people don't provide that level of detail, and I just want to call your attention to that. Moving on to the next slide, number 58. This is a sample of what the cleanup grant budget looks like. And in this slide, I just want to call your attention to the last line item, which is the cost share. If you're applying for a cleanup grant, it has a 20% cost share, as Bob did the math for you. And be sure to show that in your table. Moving on to slide number 59. This is a transition slide, and it I just want to highlight that the next few things that I'm going to talk about and kind of lump them all together are the next five criteria. And I just want to, again, call your attention to the fact that some of these points values are the same, some have changed. Be careful. Some of the sub-criteria have changed in the 2007 guidelines, so pay particular attention. Follow the directions. The next slide, number 60. On community need, it's still 15 points. It has three sub-criteria in 2007. Be sure to respond to each one of the sub-criteria. Provide a detailed description of your targeted community. Explain how the targeted community will benefit from this grant, and be sure to characterize the impact of the Brownfields project on your community. If less than 50% of the proposals are getting funded, this is how you can distinguish your application from others, by telling EPA why your community deserves to be funded, why you have blighted and distressed neighborhoods, how the community will directly benefit from us doing funding your project. Use statistics whenever possible. Be clear when you use your statistics. Tables are good ways of presenting them. Be sure to identify the source for your statistics and use them to tell your story. The idea behind this criterion of community need is that you want to gain the sympathy of the reviewer. Moving on to the next slide. I kind of went over some of this. Use all your bad statistics. If you have a community that has a very high unemployment rate or high minorities, you can even use health statistics. I've seen in proposals before that have successfully used children's blood lead information, talking about the percentage of children that exceed the acceptable levels for lead in their blood. These are good ways that you can demonstrate need for funding. Moving on to the next slide, number 62. The next criterion is sustainable reuse of brownfields. It's the same as last year. It has 12 points. Oh, pardon me. It's different from last year in that last year it had six sub-criteria, now it only has three. The three that have remained focus on pollution prevention, reduction of sources of pollution, promoting economic benefits, and also promoting vibrant community, mixed use, housing choices, walkability. These three criteria, the six have sort of condensed the three. While the other three criteria are no longer there, they're really rolled up into the three that you see. When you discuss promoting economic benefits, be sure to quantify that to the degree that you can. Moving on to the next slide, number 63. Be sure to answer each one of these sub-criterions specifically. Use whatever economic information about your community or your tax revenues, the number of jobs that you think that this project will create, those all tell a good story for economic sustainability. The sustainability of your project may hinge on plans and policies that you either have in place or that you intend to put into place. Be sure to talk about those. Talk about any efforts to develop local master plans or update those. And there's a particular note down here on the bottom. For regional planning commissions, those applications sometimes struggle because they have a hard time being specific to local communities. And to the degree that if you're a regional planning commission and applying for this grant money, be sure to tie your proposal and this criterion back to what the local communities are doing. Slide number 64. There's no change in this one from this year to last year. It's describing the extent that your project creates green space or actually saves green space. Moving on to slide number 65. Useful tips. By default, by redeveloping a brownfield site, you are likely to be preserving green space. So don't fret if you don't have a park or a library or some project like that that's a part of your overall brownfield redevelopment project. If you're preserving green space, that's an okay answer too. To the degree that you can discuss things like anti-sprawl concepts, put that in there. Use whatever you can. Remember, this criteria is only 5 points. So, you know, if you don't have a green space plan, the world has not ended for you. You will still have a competitive proposal. Moving on to slide number 66. Community involvement. This criteria has 16 points and 4 sub-criteria in 2007. Be sure to discuss your plan for how you're going to involve the local community. Discuss your efforts to develop partnerships at the local and state level. Be sure to be specific about how you will communicate the progress of the project to your community and how you can reach them. If they are multicultural, you may need to use more than one method to reach them, or reach them in different languages. Item number 4, this is particularly important. This list of community-based organizations need to have contact information and a brief description of who they are and how they're involved with the project. Next slide, number 67. On community involvement, some key points include that when you list the organizations that are involved, be careful that it's not just organizations like regional planning commissions, local economic development authorities, the mayor's office. Be sure to have grassroots neighborhood associations and other organizations, other not-for-profit organizations involved in your project to the degree that you can. When you list them, you need to know that headquarters contractor randomly contacts at least one of the partners that you list. So you want to be sure that they know that you have involved them in this application in advance, because headquarters contractor will report to the reviewers the findings of what they have discovered when they call your partner. And so you want to be sure and have this nailed. Moving on to the next slide, number 68. Community notification and community engagement are not necessarily the same things. Oftentimes as a reviewer, when you read these proposals, you can tell who just posted it on the internet and told their community versus who really had their community involved. And if in your response to this criterion you can tell that the applicant has really engaged their community in the past and really intends to continue to do so into the future, those applications score much better. About letters of support, they're not required, but if you have quality letters of support that are current and they're relevant to your project, meaning they clearly identify the project and the role of the group or person who has written the letter, then those can be attachments that are helpful to you. Moving on to slide number 69. This is the new one. Well, not exactly new, but moved from threshold to ranking. Community notification now has 12 points. This needs to be done before the award, but it no longer has to be done before the application deadline. Some of these criteria sound an awful lot like community involvement. Describe your target communities and how you intend to notify them. Under sub-criterion 2, explain why the method that you've chosen is the most appropriate, providing details about why that's a good fit with your community. Item number 3, how long do you intend to to engage them in a comment period, and what form do you intend to use to get the word out? I think item number 4 may be tricky, and you want to pay particular attention to it. It's what are your plans for addressing the comments that you receive? Answers could range from addressing these and changes to your work plan, for example, when you actually receive a selection. You'll have to be a little bit more creative on this. We expect that this community notification will be done before we try to finalize your work plan, so count on having done this before the end of July in 2007. Number 70, this is just a transitional slide, and it helps me to announce the next speaker, who's Jim Filer, and he will finish up the presentation. Thank you.
I am last, and I am leading, and we are almost done, so hopefully you're still there. Slide 70 is basically the next ranking criterion to discuss, which is the reduction of threats to human health and environment, and also the leveraging additional resources. Please note that the points have been revised, and while we've stated before that they are 30, I think we'll find out why a lot of these things are different numbers than 100. Because the reality is, for reduction of threats to human health and the environment, they are now, for assessment, 26 points rather than 20. For cleanup, they're 27 rather than 21. And for the RLF, the points are now 26, up from 21. For leveraging additional resources, the points for assessment and cleanup remain 10. However, the points for RLF have been reduced to 10 points from the 12 points previously. The reason for this is a movement of some items to another area, which we will discuss and I will point out. It's for better alignment, not because they're less important. And that's very important to remember here, is that even though they may have been moved, it doesn't mean a diminishing of how important they may be. Please advance to slide 71. Ranking reduction of threats to human health and environment remains two parts. The major items to remember when answering this section are to be specific in how the threats will be reduced, and specifically how they will be reduced. Generic addressing of problems and what might be done are not as good as what actually exists and what specifically will be done to reduce the threat. It is important to state your relationship with state, tribal, and local health departments and how you will interrelate. This is also the area that you must state if you are applying for money for health monitoring. It's also an area that gets omitted very regularly. New this area this year is a specific question regarding how you're going to tie the end use to the cleanup. The desire is to have an end use in mind that the cleanup will enhance. Please advance to slide 72. Be to the point. Talk about the specific site you have identified. If it is a community-wide, it is okay to talk broadly about the community, but the use of examples of what is intended for cleanup enhances the package. Also, specifics of what will be cleaned up and done are enhancers as well. Remember, RLFs are community-wide and not site-specific, although the use of specific examples enhance the presentation. A generally overlooked and forgotten part of the proposals are the mitigation of human health risk and the working relationships with the local, state, and or tribal health departments. Remember to summarize pertinent information rather than insert in environmental reports. Please advance to slide number 73. This section is remaining the same for assessment and cleanup. For RLF, the proposals, the point total has been reduced to 10 from 12. This is because the information regarding a dedicated program manager and a multiple-year commitment information has been moved to the business plan section. Remember to include this information in the business plan session and not here, as you did previously. The rest remains the same. Is it important to identify specific funds being used besides those being requested in the proposal? It is important to show the use of other funds and monies and how these are leveraged by the use of this grant. Remember to be specific and explanatory. Identify specific fund or money commitments contingent on this proposal if you have any, as they will enhance the grading of this. Please advance to slide 74. The business plan in the RLF is worth 24 points, just as it was previously. Please advance to slide 75. This RLF section remains basically the same as previously, except for the transfer of the information regarding the dedicated program manager for at least 50% of their time, along with multiple year commitment to this area from the leveraging area. Remember this change as I spoke to earlier. It is important to explain your loan subgrant program in detail. Also explain how other funds and resources will be incorporated into this loan subgrant program. Explain how the RLF is intended to revolve. Be specific in who is being targeted for loans and subgrants. Describe the selection process and your prioritization goals. Explain how the program will be marketed. Identify strong potential borrowers that are imminent and how this program is ready to be launched upon attaining this grant. Explain in detail the oversight as well as the prudent management and lending practices that will be used on this grant. Explain how subgrantee and borrower eligibility will be met and how these determinations are made in accordance with the Brownfields Law. Please advance to slide 76. Please note that programmatic capability is now worth 20 points for the assessment, cleanup, and RLF grant submissions. The site selection process remains 6 points. Please advance to slide 77. This area has been reworked. The basics remain the same, however, consolidated into 4 sub-criteria. Be specific in how you will manage and oversee the grant. Be upfront with any previous issues you have incurred on earlier grants. This is very important, is that you can run, but you can't hide, so to speak. The emphasis in this section is now performance and successful accomplishments with good management and reporting. Toot your horn, or your own horn, if you have accomplished EPA successes. However, remember, if you have not had a previous grant, to put not applicable NA as it is stated in there. This is the way you will be graded neutrally. If you do not follow this procedure as outlined, you will be graded a 0, which is less points and will cost you. So it is important to follow their directions. Previously, this neutral rating has been an average score for the section. Remember, if NA is not followed, you will get a 0. Please advance to slide 78. Remember, tip 1 now applies to the business plan section. The tip for responding to adverse audit findings is very important. Don't try to hide anything. Please advance to slide 79. These tips are important. The EPA is promoting timely and accurate reporting, so show this if possible. Indicate positive results on current EPA grants if applicable, and highlight accomplishments. Finally, describe tracking plans and plans for monitoring progress toward expected outputs and outcomes. Accountability and achievements have become very important. Please advance to slide 80. The site selection process for assessment only remains 6 points. The criteria are unchanged from previously. Describe how sites were or will be selected. What is the site selection criteria? How are sites determined to meet eligibility for funding under the statute? It is important to explain access arrangements for assessments on privately owned sites. Inventory planning and prioritization efforts also need to be explained. Please advance to slide 81. Each of these useful tips remain important. Describe the site selection. The proposal writers do not respond to the access issues and therefore lose points. Don't overlook this for privately owned sites. Consider including factors relating to other ranking criteria. Please advance to slide 82. Key steps for applicants. Draft your proposal. Contact state, tribe, and EPA with eligibility questions. Contact your partners for assistance in preparing or reviewing your proposal. Contact state if applying for petroleum. Set up the public meeting. Put the notice in the paper and get state acknowledgement letter. These are all very important and the key steps and will help you. Please advance to slide 83. For additional information, we've included numerous people here. The first is the Branch D. Steve Kovac for competitive and threshold issues. We also have the assessment with Brad Vann, who talked earlier. The cleanup is with Deborah Kennedy, and the RLF is myself. Please advance to slide 84. All-day Brownfields Grants workshops, improving your Brownfields grant proposal, are planned and are in place. They are on October 19th for Omaha, Nebraska, and October 25th for Kansas City, Kansas. there can be registered at the site shown in this slide, or to contact Nicole Clark, who spoke earlier. And I will turn this back over to Stephanie now for questions and answers.
Actually, at this point, I thank you for sticking it out with us to the end of the presentation. And Nicole, you have questions. Do you have any questions on the internet? Any email questions?
Hi, Stephanie. I do. I have two here that I'll go ahead and do, and then we can open it up to questions on the phone.
Okay.
And I also encourage people to continue submitting questions. You're listening by simulcast. The first question is, what is an example of a nonprofit, and how can that relate to a private developer?
This is Bob Richards. A not-for-profit is going to be one that is defined under the Internal Revenue Code. Basically, EPA has chosen to default to that definition of a not-for-profit 501c3 corporation. So you have to have that status in order for us to consider you a not-for-profit. There are other 501 type of organizations, but that are not necessarily in there for the profit business, but they wouldn't qualify as the charitable type of organization that is under a 501c3. The example I can give, I think, would be a political party or a chamber of commerce. Those are not going to be considered a not-for-profit. The chamber of commerce example I give is there's a code that describes organizations that have a particular purpose, and they, you know, that is, it's not the public purpose. They're in it for themselves. They're not for profit, but it's the 501c3 we're looking at.
They were looking for an example of one that does relate to itself, or to
a community development corporation. I think sometimes there might be a church or a faith-based organization that will have the 501c3 status that can apply for a cleanup grant, something like that.
The second part of that question was, how can that relate to a private developer?
I don't know. Somebody else have? I don't know. Okay, Susan Klein here has it.
Hi, this is Susan Klein. The example that comes to mind for me would be something that might deal with a community development corporation, because it's my understanding that they often will partner with private developers and may, for example, hold a property while it's being cleaned up with an agreement in place that they're going to flip the property to that private developer after it's done. But so that's an example of a relationship that might work here.
And I will just add generally to that that cleanup, you know, we want it redeveloped, but we don't, you know, after the cleanup is done, it's the eligibility and the threshold issues all apply at the time you're using the funds, but the fate of the property afterwards, you want to see it used beneficially, but it could be a private party that owns it afterwards.
Thank you. The second question is a question related to slide 36 and slide 33. And the question is, how does the comfort letter in slide 36?
Okay. You were cutting out there. Could you repeat, please?
How does the comfort letter in slide 36 work with the last bullet in slide 33?
Okay. The comfort letter would be for the reasonable steps, and then the last bullet in slide 33 occur prior to acquisition of the property. I can describe what a comfort letter would contain related to the reasonable. It's normally the reasonable steps, but you're dealing with properties that have contamination on them. The proper person acquiring the property is a bona fide prospective purchaser. They may not have acquired it. They may be doing this delayed acquisition prior to this deadline of June 30th of the following year. And so I guess the question would be that, well, the disposal has occurred. They're going to be acquiring as a bona fide prospective purchaser. They've already done some assessment work. EPA could write a comfort letter saying that based upon the assessment that was done, we feel that you can acquire the property provided you put a fence around it or something, or that there be another reasonable step. Normally it would be a fencing requirement or something to restrict access. I'm sorry, did that answer, whoever typed in the question, did that answer the question?
I'll give them a moment to respond online. At this time, I want to open it up to questions on the phone, so please feel free to pose a question.
Bob, this is Dave Cook. I got a question on the continuing obligations. I'm hoping you could have a clarification on the memorandum for the land use controls. I'll read it for the rest of the group. It says, EPA believes the statute requires bona fide prospective purchasers, contiguous property owners, and innocent landowners to comply with land use restrictions and to implement institutional controls, even if the restrictions or institutional controls were not in place at the time the person purchased the property. Is there any recent clarification on that?
No.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah, 'cause
that's given some of the grantees some heartburn now in looking at applications. That how do they predict that?
Yeah, it's something I guess you could call. I'll repeat that you can call me in. It's a threshold issue, so we can talk about it and not violate the competition policy.
Okay.
Stephanie?
Yes.
Yeah, Jim Gilstrap. It seems like the number of pages on these proposals gets smaller year by year. You mentioned 15 pages for the proposal. That includes the one page typically that covers the threshold criteria. Is that correct?
It's Susan telling me it's 18 pages in the guidelines?
It's 18 pages, and that includes everything but the specific attachments that are listed.
Okay. You mentioned two pages for a cover letter.
Well, it doesn't have to be two pages. I don't think they give a specific figure on how many pages that should be. But the cover letter and the narrative, which is the answers to all the threshold criterion and the ranking criterion, have to fit within 18 pages. There are a few things such as your waiver request, your site-specific eligibility determinations, if you need one of those, that can be acceptable attachments.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to throw out a caution that maps, charts, things like that, it looks like those have to fit within the 18 pages this year if you want to use something like that. I mean, if you want to submit those kind of attachments, you do it at your own risk. They may get cut.
Maps and charts are considered not to be attachments or part of the proposal.
I think they're not listed in the attachment list. I haven't gotten clarification from the Sun headquarters, but they're not included in that. When I read this over, and I've read it a couple of times, and it's open for interpretation, it read to me like, so if you don't include those in your 18 pages, they probably would get cut. And I've seen some nodding of heads around the room that others have read it the same way. But
so you definitely want those at the end.
We got these officially yesterday, so we're scrambling ourselves on interpreting this.
So you want definitely want those at the end, because they start cutting after page 18, right?
Right, and this is a really good thing to bring up, because last year, as we noted, program capability is worth more points this year. It's our last criterion. And last year, I read at least two proposals from other regions where they got a good chunk of that chopped because they were over 18 pages. So they lost a chunk of points. So we're serious about the 18. Well, last year was 15, but the page limitations are serious.
Okay, because I thought at the beginning somebody said 2 pages cover letter and 15 for the proposal, so I'm glad you clarified that.
But I think they were just thinking of last year's.
Okay.
Again, we got it yesterday, and
we were scrambling.
We were scrambling and teaming around here trying to get through all this stuff.
It starts on page 17 of the guidelines, and it says, including the cover letter, and there's no specification for exactly how many pages. Then it says, shall not exceed 18 pages. Then further on page 19 of the 2007 guidelines, it says, pages exceeding the maximum page limitation expressed above will not be copied or evaluated. The maximum limitation does not include required attachments identified in section 4B1. So,
a couple other things they did this year, just since you've raised these issues, is they specify the font size. So, you know, pay attention to all those little nitpicky issues.
Yep.
And just, again, a reminder that proposals have to be postmarked by December 8th. And if you are going to go through www.fedgrants.gov, you'll want to make sure you start that process early enough so that you can get through the electronic system. We know from experience that sometimes those things clog up the last day or two. So our strongest advice would be not to wait till the last day to do the electronic method if that's what you're going to do.
Okay.
Other questions on the phone?
Do we have any more electronic questions? Any email questions, Nicole?
We do not.
Okay.
Okay,
any more questions by phone? Going once. Oh, surely we went through this pretty fast. I can't believe there aren't any questions. You can call us at EPA and ask us threshold questions in before the competition closes. We can't answer questions on ranking, but you can contact your state contact for help on your proposal and for more specific guidance on how to successfully answer the ranking criteria. So I'll just put in that plug for state contact. And do not forget about the all-day sessions if you're confused or if you need more help. And if there are no more questions, thank you all very much for participating, and we look forward to your successful proposal.